electing what? The Jordan River into the promised land. Moshe would have ushered in what era? The Messianic era. Moreover, the eschatological era. And Moshe, the greatest of teachers, the most outstanding of among prophets, the wisest man in human annals, would have captured also the crown of King Messiah. Thus, climbing up, Moshe would have succeeded to climb up the mount of the war to the very apex, to the pinnacle of Lucifer. Then the ideal would have been fulfilled completely, realized, fully. The ultimate end would have been achieved. The end beyond which there is only the desert of silence, inactivity, nothing else could men ask for. The destiny would have been completely fulfilled. That couldn't have happened. Moshe had to be defeated. All his ideals couldn't have been fulfilled in their lives. And Moshe was near the apex. So God told him, here you stop. The crown of Messiah is ready for somebody. You will remain the greatest of all prophets, the lawgiver, the most outstanding leader in human annals. You will be considered as the architect of the people. The Dutch nation in Israel will be the standard phrase of Jewish courts and Jewish botadini for the crown of Messiah. That crown is reserved for somebody else. Everything cannot be done or reached. You must lose something. You must be defeated because you are human being. Now we can understand how Gedusha and humility, merge into one. Let us say, what is the awareness of Gedusha? I am Niyota because I am a great being. State the Gedusha awareness. Statesman, then is aware of his Gedusha. I am Niyota. Why am I Niyota? Why am I admitted into his presence? The answer is, man is created in the image of God. He's a great being. He's a singular being. He's a unique being. He's not like the brute in the field, like the beast in the forest. I was, but the very instinct, the awareness of the Gedusha state, I am holy because I am near God, comes another awareness. And states, but I'm not satisfied with that realness. I want to be a bit closer to God, to Him. And I can't achieve complete merger, a complete union, because I am a small being. So while the very moment, the Gedusha, the positive Gedusha awareness states, I am near God, that's why. I mean, I'm holy. So the awareness of the peace intervenes immediately. Yes, you are near. But are you satisfied? Oh no, I'm not satisfied. I want to be closer. I want to be united with Him in the most perfect manner. That I cannot get. Why can't I get it? Because I'm a small being. This is dialectical awareness. I am near God because I'm great, I'm not as near as I would like to be, but I'm small. And the middle is the transition from Kedusha to what? To humility. Now we have just to analyze what does the aspects of humility, because humility flows from the awareness of defeat, which comes hand in hand with the awareness of Kedusha, which is basically awareness of victory. The awareness of defeat expresses itself in awareness of dependence. And I'll be a very practical, not philosophical. And awareness, or I would say, feeling of dependence, which is the first step which the Talmid Chacham or the Ben Tera makes on his way toward total humility. I'll here enumerate five steps which a person must make in order to achieve total humility. The first step is the one of dependence. And let us say Talmud Chochom. And the Talmud Chochom somehow becomes aware that he is dependent. Dependent upon whom? The person blessed with Kedusha. And Talmud Chochom, now I use it in a sense, not scholarship, but any Jew who is related to Torah is concerned with Torah, who is a child of Mother Torah. The person blessed with Kedusha is aware of the fact that there is someone, who climbed a few steps higher than he did. That he is in the need of advice, guidance and instruction by somebody who knows a little more than he, who came a few inches closer to the summit of the mountain of the Kaddish Baruch Hu, and who was more successful in his pursuit of Torah and Kedusha. Since I am overpowered by the awareness of defeat, it means I have not achieved what I want to achieve. And I feel frustrated. No matter how much I did achieve. So the awareness of defeat tells me something else. There is somebody within the Jewish community that knows more than you. That's wiser than you. That accomplished more than you. That is a little bit closer to Kaddish Baruch Hu than you are. The Talmud Chochom is cognizant that his need for health and enlightenment grows with his ascent. That the more he knows, the greater is the reward. The more conspicuous is his perplexity. The closer he is to the Creator, the clearer is his awareness of his inadequacy and failure. You know the famous saying by the Rambam. What is it? What is it? I can't. Right, love it. Tachlis Haidior, the ultimate goal of knowledge. No, it's not right. He allows me to say, is to despair. To find yourself in a state of despair in resignation. That's exactly. And if I'm despair, and I'm resigned because I'm ignorant, I've got to be humble enough to admit that somebody else knows more than I do. Who is this somebody else? Sometimes it's a great scholar, sometimes it's a little child, and sometimes it's your own pupil in classroom. How many times do my people catch me in this most ridiculous errors and mistakes? Upon whom one is dependent? Very hard to guess. Usually upon a head. Is suddenly not only troubled under the impact of the awareness of defeat and need independence, he suddenly begins to yearn for people, for companionship, for a teacher, a master, a friend, a comrade. He becomes gregarious, socially minded. He is frightened by his solitude and guided and egocentrism. He is overcome in deed of a power by a burning desire and passion to join up with someone, an individual, a group of scholars whose powers of intuiting and understanding exceed his. If you should ask me, who may claim to do share? I would say the one who feels the need for a teacher, for a leader, for a candidate, who wants to play the role of a talmate forever. The one who says, a savor for God, a neighbor for God. And the Rebbe sometimes is a scholar, and sometimes the Rebbe can be your own little girl who corrects you from time to time. And she is right, and you are wrong. Then Kherach said, Kichol reizo kulom gdeshim, Ubeseichom adishem. The whole community is holy, and God is present in their midst. He stated an elementary truth. He was right. Every Jew has a share in the Torah as well as in the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Then, however, he raised the question, the one with the snafu of Talmudism, he committed a fatal error, which invited disaster. The premise was right, the conclusion wrong. Why was the conclusion wrong? Kherach thought that since everybody is blessed with Kedusha, a great teacher like Moshe has no function to perform. The reverse was true. Since every member of the community was endowed with Kedusha, the need for a master, for a teacher, for a guide and leader, who was the greater, more pressing than ever. The more the Jew is pressing for Kedusha, the greater is his feeling of dependence upon somebody who is superior to him. And believe me, it's very hard for a Hashimi, for a world, for any Jew to say that somebody else is superior to him. But this is the first step on the way to our total humility, the feeling of independence. That's why the Hashimi and Rabbi say, when you pass the Shaila and you render a decision, do it slowly, inquire as a colleague, as a teacher, as a rebbe. Don't be hasty, don't try to impress the woman who called you on the phone and asked you a question. That you are omniscient and you can resolve all problems within a split second. This is contrary to the awareness of dependence. Now, the awareness of dependence expresses itself in another feeling. It's a part of the awareness of dependence. But as far as emotions are concerned, as far as the classification of feelings are concerned, it is different from the awareness of dependence. Namely, the awareness of dependence expresses itself in gratitude and loyalty. The proud, vain person is an ingrate, because he simply cannot admit that somebody else has a share in his success. His little ego feels offended whenever it is suggested to him that these accomplishments are to some extent due to the kindness and cooperation on the part of others. Yahadus, and this is basically Yahadus, believe that man is never self-sufficient. Never self-sufficient. He always is in need of help. I'm not speaking now in need of help, I have to be but in need of help of his fellow man. There is a figure in Tanakh, the way the Tanakh portrays him, he believed firmly that he is self-sufficient. He never asked for favors, and whatever he did and accomplished is due to him, to his own power, his own talent. Who is he? Who is he? Huh? Yes. He's not a very sympathetic figure, you must say that. Have you ever heard of a man by the name Noble or Carnelli? Neighbor? Carmel? Have you ever heard of a man by the name Noble or Carnelli? Never? No, really? How many did you hear of the name? Noble or Carnelli? Well, what book is his name mentioned? Shmuel, at the end of Shmuel. So you do know him. You are a good acquaintance. Only Noble spoke in terms reminiscent of the negativist who feels that he and Noble Henry has been the master of his own destiny. And you know how he expressed it? Through one youth. When David sent the message to him with the request that since he is celebrating festival, harvest festival, clipping the lamb, the sheep, he should donate something to David and his associate, his followers. And Nabal rejected, and he said as follows, "V'nokachti es lachmi, ואשמני ותפחשי אשר תבחתי לגזבוי ונסעתם לאנשים אשר לא ידעתי אם זה אמו I'll say in English, shall I take my bread and my rectangle and my water and my flesh that I have killed for my sinners and give unto men of whom I know not well they are. What does it express? The mentality of Nabal, who felt everything is his, self-made man. What you call it in America, a ratio, I'm just a story. Self-made man, small town boy made good. He felt he owed nothing. He owed nothing to anybody. May mean lachmit if chasid is enough. Such an approach is contrary to the very letter and spirit of Yahadus. The humble man must feel indebted to his fellow man in a variety of ways. This principle prevails in the domain of material as well in that of spiritual success and achievement. Loyalty is a central verity in Jihadism. It's very interesting. If we read a story of Abraham's life, we don't understand the one thing, namely, why the Torah so concerned with Lot, and tells us about Lot quite a lot. You know, the Torah is very terse and brief. What did Lot contribute to our Jewish destiny? And the Torah mentions him many times. He accompanied Abraham, and then he parted, and then he chose the area, the place of Sodom and Gomorrah. And then he was captured and taken prisoner. Why is it necessary for us to know? The Torah has told us so little about Israel, so special about Abraham himself. After all, the story of Abraham, the way the Torah tells us, begins at what age? At 75? We would like to know a lot about Abraham's youth, about his adventures. How did he discover God? How did he study the heaviness of the thunder and the steel sunlight? How did he come to the conclusion that the star is just the instrument in the hands of the Almighty? We would like to know what it is. It's very short and big, and about what the Torah tells us a lot. Is he such an important personage? We get the impression that the Torah has singled out Lot in order to tell us something else. Namely, that Abraham's main central virtue was what? Loyalty and gratitude. Lot was introduced into the biblical drama not because the Torah was concerned with him as a history-making and destiny-shaping biblical hero. He was far from that. But as the person to whom Abraham felt committed, and for whose sake he went to war, even though Lot had betrayed him and departed from him. You know the famous expression of Chazal, the Epshi be'Avron, I don't like Abraham, the Epshi be'Lakor, I don't like his God either. Why did Abraham do that? Not because of the blood for him. Not because of that. Because Chazal tells us that Leah did a favor to Abraham once upon a time. And Abraham came to Mitzrayim, to Egypt, and told the Egyptians that Sarah is a sister. Lot knew the truth, and he wanted very much to tell the Egyptians, don't believe the old man. She is his wife, but he restrained himself, he controlled himself. It was a favor. But a favor. And that favor Abraham never forgot. That's loyalty. And that's what a favor requires of everybody. You ask me, to whom should we give loyalty? To whom? I'll tell you, to many. First of all, to father and mother. If one owes loyalty, he does owe it to father and mother. Second, to the teacher, to the rebbe, to the Rosh Yeshiva. My family should give their loyalty to me. I can get along with that. Correct. This is not his guide. I'm dependent upon them. Let me reverse myself. Nixon may reverse himself, I may reverse myself. I'm dependent upon them, and I insist upon them. I'm not, you know very well, I'm not out for publicity, and I don't like it. I'm a Soviet, I certainly don't like flattery and a jerk. But I make demands upon my Talmud. I want loyalty from them. And I should feel that the Talmud betrayed me, or display the disloyal attitude currently, so I'll never forgive them. Basically, I cannot bear grudge against anybody. But I have a grudge. Whether it's according to the law, I don't know. Perhaps I deceive myself against anybody who committed an act of treason against me, who showed a relationship of disloyalty. And this goes not only for me, it goes for every machine that I have. I'm sorry to say, American boys, with respect to their teachers, don't know what loyalty means, and what loyalty stands for, and what gratitude is. The very moment they get through with it again, they close the door, they turn their back on the classroom, and the books, and the teacher. And this is basically an anomaly which is responsible for many negative phenomena. Don't you be loyal to the teacher who opened up to you the gates of a blissful world of devotional value, to friends and comrades who help you, and also, and I may say, to the institution where you studied and where you acquired your knowledge. Of loyalty and gratitude, I have in mind another kind of a chorus table of loyalty. May I say, even love, a great passionate and fiery love, which you owe, you know, to him, to whom? To the countless generations of Chachmei Amaseo, those strange teachers, saints, dreamers, visionaries, who labored diligently and painstakingly with their mind to formulate the cognitive methodology of Tevah Shabbat, to interpret difficult texts, to analyze its ideas, to develop its logic and epistemology, to define precisely flaws, and to explain the complex equations in the Torah Shabbatah, and to communicate all this in a living, personal way to us. You owe your loyalty to Jewish history, to those people who sacrificed everything temporal for the eternal Messiah. A humble person owes a debt of gratitude to those countless teachers. Now, let us take the second step on the way to total humility. First was the feeling of dependence. The second step on the way to total humility is intellectual caution or circumspection. You can choose the word which you like best. The awareness of defeat engenders in a person a feeling of intellectual modesty. Intellectual modesty, caution, or circumspection. Let me spell it out in simple terms. A humble Talmud Chacham is careful in rendering halachic decisions. He knows that there are certain problems which are indeed almost insoluble. regardless of pressure exerted on him. All the ignorant and arrogant people maintain that all questions are answered. And all the arrogant and ignorant people maintain that it is the duty to our Papa Lord to resolve all problems and to answer all questions. The humble Talmud Chacham is particularly cautious in his interpretations of the Hadith vis-à-vis the problems of modern life. Intellectual caution is identical with intellectual shyness. The humble Talmud Chacham does not proclaim high-sounding theories about the Hadith, which have no roots in our tradition. He does not make sweeping statements about Jewish philosophy or axiology, Jewish ethics, and etc. I don't know what else it is. The humble Talmud Chacham does not attempt to generalize where generalizations are misleading. The humble person will never boast that the Hadith is commodious enough to embrace any modern theory, even communism. He knows very well, the humble Talmud Chacham, that the Hadith is very modern, at times extremely progressive, and at times very conservative and very old-fashioned. It is difficult to formulate theological, philosophical thesis on the basis of a single minor chazal. And he knows that only a man who is an intellectual giant and who has the halacha at his fingertips, that he used to say of Kepler, that he had the stars at his fingertips, only a man who has the halacha at the fingertips may venture cautiously to infer some philosophical conclusion from halachic premises. The humble Talmud Chacham knows what the Rambam says. On the tile of the parties, Ellen Cain really traces the best of the eye. To take a walk in the paradise of knowledge is not so easy. One must have first a good meal, a good steak, and strong wine. On an empty stomach, the mouse who actually makes such sleeping statements are hungry and starve for food. On an empty stomach, I would not advise anyone to take a walk through the park. Now the third step towards and the way to our total humility is ethical modesty. I spoke before about intellectual modesty, intellectual caution, intellectual circumspection, shyness, to be shy, and to be able to admit, I don't know. But there is also ethical modesty, which is the third step on the way to humility. The awareness of defeat and dependence urges the humble Talmud Chacham to be modest in his self-valuation as a moral personality. He must be aware not only of his intellectual dependence upon others, but also of his ethical imperfection and inadequacy. Nothing is repugnant to the Hadith as self-righteousness and moral complacency, which unfortunately afflicts many within the Orthodox Jewish communities.
hear the melodic song as well. The Talmud Chacham is an assuming, is retiring person, always ready to admit an error, to acknowledge an oversight, to confess and say chotasi. He will never set himself up as a shefet, a justice, sitting in judgment of a poor mortal, whom he finds, of course, guilty. The Talmud Chacham resents all those perfect, pious men whose perfection and piety consist not in a greater commitment to Torah. They study more than anybody else. Or in Avodah, they pray with greater fervor. But when it's chassadim, they are extremely charitable. No. Piety consists in their pride and vanity, in their ludicrous self-complacency, in their arrogance to criticize easily and to condemn anybody who does not agree with them. This is pride, this is vanity. The humble Talmud Chacham, when I explain to Gdusha, the humility must not wait. The fourth step on the way to total humility is associated, I would say, with the movement of recoil, or this retreat, using a Kabbalistic term, this thinking, middle of thinking. The humble Talmud Chacham must know the art of self-contraction, the art of thinking. And I explain to you what I mean by it. Of course, the same Talmud Chacham, who is hunger for wisdom, for spiritual fulfillment, is insatiable, whose quest for Gdusha is interminable, is nevertheless quite often also capable of self-limitation, of tzimtzum. The Talmud Chacham is a disciplined, self-controlled, and self-efficient person. He possesses the ability to stop, to give up, to abandon, and to retreat, even though, quite often, giving up and retreat or abandoning are not required by the letter of the law. The type of thinking in which the Talmud Chacham is supposed to exercise, if he wants to be humble, but if he's not humble, he's not in the Talmud Chacham. This type of thinking in which the Talmud Chacham must exercise, I mean, is applicable to several areas of human endeavor. First of all, the physiological area. You ask me, it's so simple, yeah, it is simple, but not many understand it. But the Talmud Chacham must be capable of foregoing many carnal pleasures, even though there is no strict prohibition against them. And let me read a few sentences from Rambam Milchus Beis, which will explain vividly. I mean, what I have in mind. The Rambam writes in Dort 5, comma 2. I'll read it in English because the reading both texts will take up time. A scholar should not be a glutton. Rambam is a glutton as far as food is concerned. And I say glutton sometimes is related to publicity and to comfort as well. But will eat just food conducive to health? And fill not, and will not eat to excess. It's unhealthy thing. The wise man will partake of one or two causes, of which you will consume as much as you need in order to sustain yourself. This is as far as physiological symptom is concerned. There is social symptom. Social exhibitionism is certainly reproachable and contrary to humility. Indulgence in luxury manifests pride and vanity. My mother is right, the scholar dress should be becoming and clean. He should not put on robes befitting royalty, such as those embroidered with gold or purple, which attract attention. Our home should not attract attention, not even attention of the New York Times. Not even attention of the New York Times on front page and on the editorial page. This is contrary to the basic principles of humility. Is concerned with the Talmud Chacham's emotional life. When the Talmud Chacham is elated, happy, God was good to him, and he met his success, he joyfully but calmly acknowledges his indebtedness to God, praises him, destroys. Yet, he feels no need to tell other people of his accomplishments, of his victories, of his success. Why bread? Why those? Why problem solve? Somebody did it. You know who? Who bragged and boasted and publicized his accomplishments. But is there anything as well? Hey man, by supper and homo is kredosha yereg bono, is kolasha gidle yamara. We Jews, Torah Jews, have always been fearful of Ayahuasca. The first look at tablets in our shepherd, because the revelation was over publicized. Why dance? Why be, if one is happy, why be intoxicated, even if one is successful? Of course, great is the joy who within one's home. However, the greater the happiness, the calmer the exterior. The more restrained the Talmud Chacham is, the less does the outside world know of his success and victory. Joy, in terms of humility, must not be confused with merrymaking. And happiness must never be confused with hilarity. On the other hand, what I'm saying here is the philosophy of a kind of this is true portrayal of his personality. On the other hand, if someone is in trouble, in distress, God Rahman al-Islam turned away his countenance from him, everything seems absurd, everything seems to be in disarray, suspended in midair. So what? Let him pray to the Almighty, pour out his heart in solitude, quietly, from the depth of an anguished soul. Yet one must be careful not to cry aloud, not to become hysterical, and not to solicit the pity of humans, not to lose self-dignity, even in despair. The greater the Talmud Chacham, the greater care he must exercise in disciplining his emotions, in not betraying to others the stress and exasperation he is experiencing. My father used to say, with regard to the person, the dual operations in a Kiddush and Kiddush of aggression, and the curtain should separate the sanctuary from the Holy of the Holies. Holy of the Holy. The sanctuary, the Kiddush, is human thought, human intellect. It is holy, but not the holy of the holies. It is not the sanctum sanctorum. It is Kiddush. A Kiddush of a person in the world is his emotional life. Love, compassion, anguish, exaltation, joy, sadness, pity, they are the holy vessels which have been placed by the Almighty in that sanctum sanctum, in the holiest place in the human personality. What man is called upon to externalize, to objectify, to personalize? If I know Torah, it's my duty to teach Torah. Thought has a tendency to externalize itself, to be objectified in words in print, and so forth. Emotional life should remain the secret, the exclusive secret of the human personality. And the curtain should separate the cages, the world of thought, which is just holy, from the world of human emotions, which is the most secret dimension of the human personality. He has a right, not only a right, a duty, to exhibit his thought. One has no right to display his emotions. And that's exactly where Midas HaTzimtzum should be echoed from. And that is the fourth step of humility. We'll come. And finally, we come to the fifth step, which is the last one, on the way to humility, namely generosity. If you want to say, to use a Hebrew term, what would you suggest? Chesed. You know, chesed is always for me the flavor of a lower. Chesed is there. What does the latter denote? Simply, I depend upon others. Others are also dependent upon me. In the same fashion as I expect others to guide me, the others have a right to expect me to guide them. What does chesed mean? Chesed, the way the Rabbi has described in the last chapter of the Mirror of Him, does not mean just giving away to somebody else, but opening up of the self and embracing the other fellow as a part of oneself. When the barriers of I and thou are torn down, when man steps out of his existential solitude, of his egocentric abode, and becomes completely united to the other fellow, Chesed is realized. Chesed, in accord with the Rambam's interpretation, signifies an august flow of spirituality, knowledge, enthusiasm, happiness, warmth. When men cannot contain all this beauty he sees, all truth he knows, all the kindness he feels, when everything in him, like the river in spring, rises above its normal bed, within which the stream of consciousness flows, carrying along all those treasures, all those marvelous riches, ideas, values, visions, dreams, and hopes. So when this river rises above the bed and inundates the environment, Chesed is realized. Maimonides' philosophy of education is based on this spontaneous, elemental breakthrough of the human personality. Teaching for him is an explosion of the personality which cannot resist anymore the pressure from within. The man has no choice, he has to give. In the same manner as man sometimes has no choice, he has to love. Particularly, it is true of the woman. The woman's desire for a child, the father's desire for a child, is usually a result of human fear of death. And actually, I mean, the father sees himself immortalizing the child. And the fear of death, that's what drives the father. To beget his children in order somebody should succeed in and continue his work. And somehow he will immortalize him. Mother's desire for a child is not based upon fear of death and the desire for immortalization, not at all. Mother's desire for a child is based upon the need that a woman feels to love. Of course, a person who wants to be loved, a person also wants to give love. And sometimes the need to give love is stronger and more powerful and more overwhelming, certainly more ennobling than the desire to be loved. To be loved is a selfish desire. To love is a desire of chesed, is a gracious desire. And Chazal says, "Chano mitaberes halipo." The Gemara in Brachos interprets, it means Chano speaks about her heart, close to her heart. Chazal says, "Alif kelibo." She speaks about her heart. Namely, my heart has a passion for love. I want somebody upon whom I could center all my love, all my affection. I want a child. Teaching according to my mind is desiring person to love somebody else, to give, to share riches which one possesses, and don't know what to do with it. It's somebody else. And my mind speaks in like the way. And the way means a great experience which the mother cannot contain within itself. He has to tell his mother. And he quotes Jeremiah when he said that once he made up his mind not to prophesy anymore, because prophecy brought him affliction, humiliation, and despair. But I couldn't, Jeremiah said. God's word. Case they are flickering, was like a burning fire in my bones. I couldn't tolerate anymore. I had to explore. and to be able to prophesy. And this is to my mind as teaching. This is chesed, and this is generosity. Man has no choice. Even if he must be generous, because he has too much. He overflows his spirituality, his knowledge, his talent, his beauty. He has to share with someone else. So from the problem he acknowledges his gratitude, his dependence upon others, who are above him in the hierarchy of Torah and Kedusha, must realize that there are also people who are below him in the same hierarchy, who depend upon him and need his help. And the Prophet must extend help. Nothing should be considered below his dignity. Let him teach the advanced, and let him teach the beginners. It is just as difficult to teach alphabet as to teach Shabbosar. Many times I look at stage and I thought of that. I'll be sure. I would like to teach Finnish in my voice in one class. It is just as important to teach with the bright boy, with the brilliant disciple, as it is to teach the slow one. Those, it is just the significance to explain certain concept to someone who is quick in comprehension, has to explain the same concept to someone who is slow in comprehension. Chazal says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu teaches, but not advanced people. But little children will die before they had the opportunity to get an education. And if HaKadosh Baruch Hu can do that, it's not below our dignity to do the same. But generosity makes one demand upon the Talmid Chacham. Generosity consists particularly in a sense of inner security, of confidence and faith in Klal Yisrael. If the Talmud Chacham has not confidence in faith in Klal Yisrael, the Jewish community as a whole, he will never be generous, he will never exercise chesed. He will see another flow of his kindness, he will bury it in the desert. The Talmud Chacham must not act as if he belonged to a sect which is concerned only with itself and has no trust in anybody. He must act as a member of the Knesset Israel. And the Talmud Chacham must believe, willy-nilly, whether he likes it or not. And what Maimonides said, and I quoted Maimonides, it does not stand. Uklo ifticho tiro, shesifon shor Yisroel afish tiro, v'sov golusan v'yadhin nigolin, and the Torah has already offered the assurance that Israel, meaning the people, will in the closing period of their exile, finally repent, and thereupon be immediately redeemed. Now every Jew, the Talmud Chacham must believe in that, he is humble, and it's the final step toward achieving and continuity. Every Jew has an inborn capacity for truth and a desire for Kedusha. Even though quite often it is subconscious, hidden away in the deep recesses of his personality, of which he has no idea, of which he is not aware. But there is a capacity for Tshuva Gevura, no alienated Jew, no separated Jew, no secular Jew, must be excommunicated, expelled from society. For we have never given up a single Jew. We we've only, we have never considered the most elevated truth as completely lost. This part of patience and toils we may bring back, this will be generous, this will have taken. This also true of a rebel atonement. A rebel cannot accomplish anything with atonement. This has no sacred cause. Generosity requires faith in the human being and confidence in the Holy Spirit. And the eighth in the Russian and the Nidoch in the Mitzrayim, the assimilated here and the downtrodden there, can be brought back to the fold. And we can re-educate everyone. If we believe in the words of the prophet, Shalom, Shalom, Amen, Hashem, Yerachai, Kerachai, 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 Kerachai,